Hello and welcome to the Emerald City Video Podcast. This is Russ Burlingame, and I'm here today with Ava Fermanska.
Hi there.
We're going to be talking about, well, this is technically another Summer of Riverdale episode, which you might remember from the last time Ava and I were on the show. But because I've done a very poor job of actually keeping up with the Summer of Riverdale episodes, this is actually only the second one. That said, we got two kind of very oddly disparate movies that both kind of resonate with the first season of Riverdale. The first movie is Anatomy of a Murder, which is actually the title of the penultimate episode of Riverdale's first season. The second one is Scream, which the reason we're doing this episode kind of out of order is because Scream has turned out to be super, super relevant to what we can, to kind of the second season that's coming up of Riverdale, where all of the episode titles, instead of being named after like cool noir mysteries, are all named after slasher movies.
Yeah, and this is the one that sort of turned the genre on its head in 1996. That's kind of the first slasher movie that kind of took everything off on a new course.
Yeah, it was, you know, it's funny. I didn't love Scream when I was, you know, 16 and it came out. I just wasn't into it. And so I hadn't watched it since then. And watching it fresh was really interesting because there's way more going on in it than I think you would ordinarily guess.
Yeah. It was a film I saw in the theater. And yeah, I was 17 when that came out. Mm-hmm. I saw it in the theater, and then the very next year, I went to film school. So we, it came up again and again in so many different classes, so many different courses I took. So whether you like it or hate it, it is an extremely important movie.
Yeah, I think this movie kind of, for good or ill, changed a lot of the conversation around the critical reception and discussion of kind of these cheesy slasher flicks.
I believe it is still to date the highest grossing teen horror movie ever made.
It makes sense. It's one of those weird movies that when like magazines and websites make various best of lists, it routinely shows up on the best of both teen movies and horror movies. And I would think that there's a very limited number of films that kind of have the kind of crossover that allows them to show up as best of on two different genres.
And it definitely, it's funny because I think it for me, it sparked two different things. And one of them is really obvious, which is the whole tongue-in-cheek genre mashup. Mm-hmm. But I also kind of credit it with the reboot phenomenon.
Yeah, I could see that.
And it wasn't a reboot, but it totally touched base with so many things that came before it that people started thinking, what if we did a reboot?
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that when you read about this kind of in hindsight, there's a lot of talk about how all the like Vestron Video direct to VHS, like schlocky horror movies had diminished the kind of stock in like slasher movies to the point where the only ones that were really making money prior to Scream were sequels. But after Scream, everything became so genre savvy that you started to see not just sequels, but like reboots and reinventions. And some of them are really terrible, like Jason X.
Oh yeah, and you know, then you get Scream 3 and 4, which I think were direct-to-video.
I think 4 might have been. I know 3 wasn't, because I actually saw 3 in the theaters exclusively for the Jay and Silent Bob cameo.
Oh, that's right. That is right.
But
so definitely, either way, one of the rare movies that can officially say it has cult status while also being a giant blockbuster.
Yeah, and it's funny because I misremembered kind of how this movie played out. My headcanon was that the reason it got that weird kind of mini re-release about 4 months after it originally came out was because it hadn't really worked the first time as a horror movie, and it was kind of reissued and remarketed as more of a comedy or a genre mashup. In fact, as far as I can tell, the only reason it got that reissue was because they really wanted to hit the $100 million mark at the box office.
Yeah, and they almost got 2 million. So, you know, it's pretty crazy to think about.
But one thing that's really interesting looking at this kind of in comparison to Anatomy of a Murder is the role of, like, women in both of these is super interesting. Like, with Scream in particular, they had the weird thing of being openly aware of scream queen tropes and kind of talking constantly about, like, that sort of female archetype and the female body. But it's a kind of vaguely quasi, like, it wants to be feminist but isn't quite there kind of movie. You know, they talk a lot about breasts, but you don't actually see them.
Interestingly enough, I actually wrote about Scream in film school, and I kind of posited that it is the first third wave feminist movie that, you know, you get Jamie Lee Curtis and you get some of the movies that are coming out in the 70s and 80s that would like to believe that they have some second wave feminist stuff happening. And this one turns that corner and takes on a lot of different issues that those movies did not do.
I think the part of the reason it's so interesting is because they're so overt in talking about that stuff that you get kind of the Chasing Amy thing, where Banky says all these stupid, terrible things throughout the movie, and depending on how you're reading the film, there are people who read Banky being one of the protagonists in the film and say, that's the movie's message. And then there are people who say, well, no, because Banky's clearly an idiot. So even if that's what one of the likable characters is saying, that's not the film's message.
Yeah, you get the one thing that's obviously, you know, you get Billy and his friend, whose name is escaping me now.
Yeah. And I really should
constantly kind of, let's see. Stu.
Okay.
Billy and Stu, and how they're always talking about, well, here are the rules and here's what happens next. And, you know, obviously the big one is Sydney breaks all the rules. She has sex and lives.
Mm-hmm.
She is her own savior. She, you know, doesn't need her dad. She doesn't have any, like, basically kills the boyfriend, mm-hmm. all that stuff. The other thing that is kind of a lesser noticed and talked about phenomenon is the person that she actually does get a little bit of help from at the end is Gail.
Mm-hmm.
And Gail is, like, the female villain in the 80s, the career woman, you know, who's just out for her career and to sensationalize anything, and her job represents, you know, being a newscaster and getting all these salacious details about horrific events. But Gail has, like, this whole, like, three-dimensionality to her that is very unique. She's the only one who has a successful romantic subplot.
Mm-hmm.
And she ends up getting together and being a hero with Sydney, which doesn't happen in my remembering in, like, any slasher movie.
I also think it's really interesting that she doesn't have a traditional character arc. Essentially, everybody arcs around Gail, because at the beginning of the movie and at the end of the movie, she's not particularly changed. It's mostly the perception of her on the part of everybody else in the movie that has changed.
Yeah, she definitely rekindles Sydney's kind of anger about her mother's death.
Mm-hmm.
And so she's very important to the other characters. But yeah, her arc is definitely non-traditional.
I think that I really liked the use of her as the callback, or as the kind of twist, so to speak, because like you kind of alluded to, having the dad there and having the dad having been the false killer, it would have been so easy for him to basically step in and be like, you guys just fucked up the last 2 weeks of my life and tried to kill my daughter. Now you're dead. And I feel like it would have rang really wrong in this movie because he didn't really have a personality in the film. And I think to have him step in and be the hero just because, like, he's dad and he's not dead would have been a huge, huge miscalculation.
And I think that there's a, you know, in these kind of genre films, the different characters always are stand-ins for society. And so, and, you know, hearkening back to our podcast about River's Edge, there is that whole, these kids, where are the parents? Where's the older generation? What's going on with, you know, for instance, the principal and his like sketchy, smarmy,
yeah,
trying to comfort Sydney moment. And that whole generation represents, you know, the people who would have been teenagers in the 70s and 80s. And mm-hmm. like, I think that the, obviously the casting of the Fonz is very pointed.
Yeah. I also, like,
a sexy icon in some way.
Yeah. I also think this is kind of a tangential to that, but it's something that occurred to me while I was watching it. That is another oddball thing that I feel like, I'm sure it existed on some level before Scream, but post Scream, this idea of the like major star who makes a cameo so they can get killed in a crazy way, like very clearly became a part of slasher movie culture.
Yeah.
And
I think that Drew Barrymore actually was supposed to play Sydney and then said, you know what? It would make more sense for me to be Casey.
I think I've heard that before. Yeah. So that the production of this movie, I was too young to be really, and again, I didn't love the movie when I first saw it. I actually enjoyed it more, I think, watching it 20 years later than I did when I saw it in theaters. I will say, as like watching this years later as a parent, the Barrymore scene is arguably the hardest thing to watch because it was so senseless and brutal, and then having the parents come home and like jump on the phone, which is of course one of those weird dated things where people our age can remember back when you used to pick up the phone and hear what the other person on the other end of the phone was doing, whereas now everything is on a mobile and that wouldn't be a consideration.
Yeah, and there's that, I think there's always kind of like that technology communication, you know, how there's the disconnect between the parents and the child, mm-hmm. and how they're, you know, teenagers like to have this sense of independence and not needing the parents, but then here they are and they have this invisible wall of just technology of the phone,
mm-hmm.
you know, and how that could be done now, and probably would be just done with the whole text message coming across the screen like they
yeah.
do in Riverdale and other movies and TV shows all the time.
On the Riverdale note, by the way, we should probably just mention in passing, I totally forgot when I picked Scream to be the companion to this, that the killer in Scream is Jughead's dad.
Yeah, I thought that was a very good dovetail.
also, in the episode titled Anatomy of a Murder, you actually have him going to jail for a murder that he didn't commit.
Yep.
And So it all kind of fell together nicely, and that was totally not intentional, because at the time I was just not even kind of thinking about that. But one thing I will say, Skeet, I really like Ulrich in this movie because he was so... It was so hard to get a bead on him. Like,
yeah.
One thing I thought was really interesting, there was the scene where he was in jail and you had Neve Campbell, you had Sidney getting essentially cross-examined by the sheriff in the other room, and his father was there kind of trying to get him off the hook. And you had this beat where the police notified his dad essentially that, oh, he was out and messing around at her house last night too. And his dad just kind of stares at him for the rest of the scene, like he doesn't know what's going on anymore. And meanwhile, his girlfriend has, like, turned him into the cops. And it's like, if there's anything that scene doesn't do well, is it doesn't communicate that this is a guy who's being falsely accused. Because I feel like if I wasn't the killer, and, like, the two most important people in my life were looking at me from opposite ends of the room saying, you probably just killed a dude, that would mess me up a lot. And he mostly just seems annoyed.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, when you contacted me about doing these two together for this, I was trying to think, like, okay, I've seen both these movies many times. What is the common thread? Mm-hmm. What is the combining message or thing that would make more sense to talk about? And to be honest, the first thing that came to mind was date rape, and Title IX, and false accusation, mm-hmm. and how we talk about rape, and who gets to define that, and how it is, you know, looked for and addressed. And there's definitely, you know, not that the sex between Billy and Sidney isn't consensual. I mm-hmm. feel like it obviously very, very clearly is. It's still got those kind of touchstones, like that moment when he's being interrogated. And, you know, you basically said exactly what I was going to say about that scene, that that's one of those things that you can tell just from the situation that there's something wrong. Mm-hmm. There's something missing.
I also, one of the interesting things that kind of the scene immediately after that where they go back to school, I feel like this is like the first slasher movie of the modern era with all the media coverage. And obviously they comment on that, even though they kind of ignore the fact that you can't really be pointing cameras at school while a bunch of underage kids are going in. But it was also kind of the last slasher film in the era before like Grief Counselors.
Yeah.
So it's this weird pocket of time where it's like all these kids are just under assault from all sides and they don't have any allies.
And there's this, I think maybe just because of the time period of when this happened, I found it to be kind of not believable that these particular group of kids would use this excuse of not having school mm-hmm. to have a party.
Yeah.
It made sense in the 70s and in the 80s.
Mm-hmm.
But then I was like, I don't know. I'm trying to remember back to 96 and, you know, being in high school at the time. What the sentiment was basically in society, and I don't know. I don't know if that would ring true today.
Yeah,
maybe it did then.
It's weird because, like, I this was 99 and I was out of high school, but I know that a friend of mine who was a year younger than I was passed away when I was a freshman in college, and school kind of ground to a halt. Like, they didn't cancel school, but there were, like, counselors available, and like anybody who wanted to take the afternoon to go to the funeral could, and all of that kind of stuff. And I don't remember hearing anything about anybody like exulting in like the excuse to leave, you know?
Yeah, and this movie was also made pre-Columbine. And yeah. I think that's big because the sensitivity to that would have probably prohibited this from being written the way it is.
Oh, yeah. And I mean, especially, I think that particularly because Columbine was at the time perceived as a much more unique event than nowadays, where unfortunately these shootings happen all the time. Like, yeah. I think that the visual of Ghostface with the long flowing anything would have probably been a non-starter. Like, they would have had to pick a different look.
Yeah.
I think one of the things that might possibly justify the like the idea of like, oh, we're gonna have this party that seems really inappropriate is that it was pretty clear that the kid hosting the party, whose name I can't recall, but the kid from the video store, that he was like kind of morbidly fascinated with the idea of the slasher movie coming to his hometown. And so the idea of emulating behavior that he thinks would have happened in a slasher movie, it was certainly not an overt part of the script, but if you were looking for like a no prize answer to explain why this was a thing, I could see that being the reason, especially because he was depicted as being particularly close to Matthew Lillard's character. So like the bad guys could have pushed him in that direction.
Yeah. And there's a lot of that whole, you know, when you're a teenager, the whole, you know, peer pressure is a thing.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that one of the interesting things, with regards to how they're portrayed, is that the girls are not exempt from being violent.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that passive victim role kind of is dispelled in this. You look at how Sydney behaves and even how Tatum behaves, they have a lot more just kind of aggro to them.
Yeah. Well, one of the things that struck me is in these movies, they kind of lampshade the idea that in these movies, you're always watching it going, get out of there, get out of there, get out of there. There was at least once during Barrymore's scene and once during the final fight with Sid, where rather than saying, get out of there, my brain was more like, no, just stay and finish him, because you clearly just won that fight, and then you're running away, but he's still got the knife. So the fact that, I think part of it is that there's something to be said, it's funny, because this was long before toxic masculinity was like a major buzzword topic in pop culture, but the killers are impotent man-children, and I think that the references to Psycho that you hear throughout the third act are particularly instructive in the sense that I feel like this is a much more contemporary riff on emasculated men trying to use violence to approximate masculinity.
Totally.
And when you have characters like that who then, like, periodically throughout the film, like, it isn't rare that they go to grab one of the girls and the girl, like, physically gets the better of him in the conflict.
Yeah, and then there's, like, a kind of a mini attempt of with the use of Billy's mother as the excuse for like how this all got underway.
Yeah.
To really align with that psycho plot and kind of throw it on its head, because there's that, you know, making motherhood something that's sacred and it's, you know, been violated by Sydney's mother, and now she has to pay for that, which was really done. I mean, I think maybe I would have wanted to see more of that. I think that they they didn't give Sydney's father a personality.
Yeah.
You just had to assume that Sydney's mother was not all these things
right.
that people said about her. But I'm glad that they did that, that they kept this intergenerational thing, mm-hmm. which again, totally made me think of Riverdale.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh yeah.
There's this interplay of generations that was really well done in Scream.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think it's always difficult to know when they intentionally, in a movie like this, where it's so kind of hyper genre savvy, that when you have people telling the audience, telling other characters that the motive doesn't really matter, that when you get to the third act and the motive is super shallow, I have a hard time knowing whether that is an intentional commentary or poor filmmaking or kind of a third option, which is that they saw how the third act was shaking out and then dropped some lines in early to try and give themselves an out.
Yeah.
And ultimately, like, it doesn't particularly hurt the movie, because I think there's a lot there even without that. I will say one of the things that struck me as really interesting watching this is very much like Anatomy of a Murder. You start off with your idea of who Sydney's mother is in the same way that you start out with the idea of who Mrs. Mannion is. And throughout the course of the movie, they really do a pretty effective job in both cases of making the viewer constantly reposition your interpretation of this woman and the idea that, like, okay, if we're going to stay with the idea that she is a good person, what does that mean for every subsequent revelation about this person?
Yeah, and I you know, I'd love to jump and talk about Anatomy of a Murder a little bit more, mm-hmm. Because it's honestly, the American Bar Association calls it like one of the top three most accurate representations of how trials are problematic and what's mm-hmm. difficult about building a case and how cross-examination can look. And even though they have the kind of weird, jokey asides mm-hmm. and the order in the court, you know, they always do this in movies, which it doesn't really happen if you're in a real trial where someone makes a snarky comment and then there's furor in the that doesn't happen, you know. Maybe it does, but then the judge will throw people out of chambers if it does. Mm-hmm. It doesn't just kind of get the pass. But a lot of the things, you know, even now, watching this, and it's 2017, and you get those cringy moments of like, yeah, they're going to go there. They're going to get this into evidence and they are going to say these words. Thinking about the fact that the release date of this movie was 1959.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, wow, that is some pretty intense stuff to get out there in, you know, kind of a pop culture-y movie. You've got Duke Ellington soundtrack, you've got stars, and it's a hard-hitting one. I really love this movie, and I think it must have been a very difficult movie for a lot of people to watch.
Yeah, it's really interesting to me. It's been years since I saw the movie, and it hadn't really occurred to me, I don't think, at the time, how in a trial that was happening in 1959... the very frank discussion of rape and of the details of rape would have been just absolutely gobsmacking in kind of a public space like the trial. And so you kind of go into this knowing that, like, there's a chunk of the story, and they do a really good job of having that happen out of chambers so they don't actually have to address kind of talking about it in front of the world. But, you know, even just simple things like the fact that Jimmy Stewart's character was making money on the side being a divorce lawyer prior to the film starting was like, oh yeah, that's right. Like, there's so many elements of this movie that would have been like challenging to some kind of status quo at the time when it came out that just didn't really occur to me at the time because I was watching it for totally different reasons.
Well, the interesting thing about this is that it was written by, I forget the man's name, but he was a lawyer and he based this on an actual case that he defended. So he definitely probably had these exact issues of like, how do you do a defense for someone in a society that is going to have the deck stacked against this person's wife who, you know, you hope can be a witness in a way that you're not, you know, kind of victimizing her again. And I really loved the way that Lee Remick played that character, because she was never a stereotypical cookie cutter victim. You know, you did kind of question like, what's this person's deal? Is she shady? And it kind of tricked you into realizing like, oh, but this is how people are going to look at this woman. And then you feel bad about it for thinking those things, because she's not a good victim, because she's not, you know,
the version of herself that Jimmy Stewart dresses her up like in the climax.
Exactly.
Yeah. And I thought that, one of the most interesting elements of her character was the fact that they continued to play that hand basically all the way up until the very end. Like, it wasn't, I don't think, until Mary came in with the evidence to say, like, okay, so here's what happened, that they really stopped implying that Laura might be up to more than meets the eye.
Yeah, and that's definitely true to life. I mean, that is what's happening to probably, you know, 99% of women who decide to press charges and especially considering, you know, this would be an acquaintance rape and not the random stranger who jumps out of the bushes. But on the grand scheme of, you know, someone, when you take it from the spectrum of monster who jumps out of the bushes to person who may have been your boyfriend on and off for years or your husband, you know, how these women are treated is definitely completely awful. The closer of a relationship you may have had to that person, or the fact that you let him give you a ride home, or the fact that you were drinking at their establishment.
Right.
So they do such an amazing job of really making you feel awful for making assumptions.
Yeah, and I think too that it's a testament to George C. Scott's performance that you don't get the kind of mustache twirling vindictive prosecutor that you tend to get in this sort of movie. Everybody here was very fully realized. And of course they have the scene where Bigler says to Mary that, like, having done this for a long time, I know people aren't just good or just bad, that people are a lot of things. And I think that that played through just about every character in the movie. I think that there was almost everybody had kind of redeeming qualities, and everybody had moments where you're just like, maybe this dude really did just murder a guy. You know?
Yeah. And there's something to be said, you know, from the legal aspects of how, what the film examines. And the thing that currently, you see a lot of documentaries and you see a lot of literature about, how people, what evidence gets used to get the outcome that you want. And if you're looking at the idea that this guy was sort of suggesting the defense that they end up using,
mm-hmm.
which, you know, is this the impulsive, you know, he finds the precedent.
Yeah.
Basically, he finds the precedent in the book saying, you know, this has worked in the past, but the guy initially wants to use the insanity defense,
mm-hmm.
and seeing that you really, is it ethical to lead your defendant into giving the information that you think will work best, even though they initially wanted to do something else,
mm-hmm.
and just kind of like playing with their memory or how a witness talks about something,
mm-hmm.
in order to get the judge to see the precedent. And a lot of that, you know, filling in the blanks and getting the story you want is really counterbalanced with the George C. Scott character. Because you see the guy who's like the local DA and how he wants to play it straight, but he's not prepared for this.
Right.
And George C. Scott's character knows. It's like a chess game. He knows what they're going to do,
mm-hmm.
and kind of spells it out. Like, okay, you're starting this sentence. I'm going to finish it. And then you have to start from scratch again.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think it's really interesting to me that the relationship between those two is explored almost exclusively in the courtroom. I mean, you see him briefly in chambers, but I feel like the any backstory and any baggage and all that kind of stuff that exists between Beigler and George C. Scott's character in a more contemporary movie, it would be like in the bar after the trial, they're bickering with each other and you find out that there's backstory, and like you would have a more personal thing. Here it feels like it's much more about the case, and it's much more about what's going on in the courtroom, and their personal stuff is not that important.
Yeah, the personal stuff I think is actually, it's interesting because the choice that they made was to have it be in the inn, and mm-hmm. having it between the bartender and the daughter, and how maybe they have some information that they could have given up right away, especially the bartender, but he feels like he needs to protect this woman,
mm-hmm.
who he already knows has been aggrieved,
yeah.
in some fashion, and is owed some sort of level of respect of privacy.
Mm-hmm.
So there's that personal interplay there, where you see Beigler show up and kind of try to charm the information out of him, then do some light threatening. You know, mm-hmm. that's done there. But yeah, the attorneys are limited to the courtroom and that kind of the drama playing,
yeah.
in that venue.
There's also, I think, something to be said for the fact that at the end of the day, after all of the things that they attempted and all the clever tricks and everything, that it is George C. Scott's character who kind of hurts himself, because at the end of the day, I don't know how, like, the questions he was raising were very valid in terms of, like, how do you know that he put the underwear in there? How do you know this? How do you know that? But it was not until he escalated and tried to get her to confess that she was having an affair with this guy that he really essentially torpedoed his own case, because you had that moment of, well, he was my father, so clearly that's, yeah, not happening.
I think that what was really done nicely,
mm-hmm.
And you don't really see I just looked it up, and George C. Scott's character's name is Claude Dancer. You don't see Dancer's relationship with any of the witnesses.
Mm-hmm.
And the one thing that they kind of show is when they bring in that other guy who's been in prison, and is kind of used as like a foil.
Yeah.
You know, and so it goes to show that Beagler's actually seeking out these people, doing the legwork, getting to know them, spending time with them. It's implied that this is a very small town. Everyone mm-hmm. knows everyone else. And even, you know, Barney Quill's little excursion to Canada, you know, they're really trying to get the individuals. Whereas the prosecution is very cocky of like, we know what we're going to do. We know how this is going to play out. And they're not prepared for a bombshell. They haven't done their legwork.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this is like a basic thing that they probably could have also found out.
Right.
But they just were too arrogant to try.
And I think part of that comes in the fact that I feel like George C. Scott's character is almost played like a force of nature. Like, he's this guy who rolls into town to do his thing, and then he's going to roll on, and that's his whole routine. He's almost...
That was probably a commentary on, you know, oh, of course, it's just some woman who wears tight pants.
Mm-hmm.
This is a slam dunk. We're going to go in here and we're going to do this, and we're, you know, it's obvious that she's not trustworthy, so they don't even bother.
Right. And I think there's also an element, and this might just be me looking for something that's not there, but I feel like the transient nature of this guy being a state attorney who comes in to do a thing and then who moves on is almost kind of it makes him kind of a foil for the Mannions in a weird way. Because it's not just that they take off the minute he's acquitted. Like, they also establish early in the film that was what brought them together, is the fact that they're these restless people who keep on the move. So to me, like, having the only two kind of outsider characters in this small town be the defendant and the prosecutor is interesting to me. And I'm not quite sure what to make of it outside of the fact that it feels like that was an intentional dichotomy.
What did you think of the note?
I'm just now struggling to remember what the note said.
When they try to go get paid and they discover that the Mannions have left.
Yes.
And she, you know, she's left the note that says that their leaving was an irresistible impulse.
So, yeah.
You know, just kind of tongue in cheek.
Yeah, using the defense, using the same defense that they used in the case. Yeah, I thought that was one of those. First of all, I think that obviously the implication here is that these people were guilty, or that, you know, Fred was guilty, that they allowed they thought these extenuating circumstances would get him off, and when it became clear they wouldn't, that Beagler helped them get out. And so I feel like I can't quite tell if we're supposed to take away from that these people are like kind of serial troublemakers, who, you know, they're just going to go on to the next thing and find a way to get out of it. Or if it was meant to be more of a just desserts thing for Beagler for having essentially gamed the system.
I also thought it was kind of an interesting open-ended way to not address their relationship as a couple, because that was always throughout the entire movie unsure footing.
Yeah.
Where they were heading, whether they were actually, you know, in love or just codependent. Like, she was obviously still kind of scared of him, but pushing the boundaries of it. And then they have that one scene where the trailer park owner or manager or whatever says that he had heard that she was crying when they left, you know, like,
yeah.
Was there an altercation? We never really get an answer. And even in the very end, Laura Mannion is, you know, who knows? Mm. Definitely a victim in one way, but is she a victim in more ways? Do we still give her, you know, more sympathy, more grief that not only did she survive this thing that, you know, but there was also potentially something else that we're getting in the last moment, basically like the last scene of her existence.
Yeah. And that's, I like that because I think that the ambiguity of the ending serves the fact that throughout the movie, there was a lot of ambiguity as to exactly what was going on with these people. And so there's a sense of kind of finality to the lack of finality, because it, to me, it basically says like that this is who these people are, that they are kind of a mystery that you're not supposed to know the answer to.
I think it also kind of, in a more of a comment on society, highlights and underscores the fact that your victims are not going to be perfect, innocent angels. And maybe they are bad people, or maybe they have done something bad, but in no way does that justify it. This other thing that's unrelated,
right?
Happening to them.
Yeah. It's interesting to me because I feel like using Bigler as the protagonist instead of using either of the Mannions allows you to do this case where the objective of getting them acquitted doesn't, like, you can kind of look at it a little bit more clinically, because it's like, this is his job, and it's not about their passion, and it's not about their backstory, and it's not about what went on between the two of them. And so to me, like, I feel like that was one of those choices where, like, using this particular point of view instead of shifting the point of view to any other character in the movie, I do feel like this is such a complex world that they've built, that any other character in the movie would have a slightly different take and it would be a different film.
Yeah, there's so many other things that are going on in this movie. There's so many wonderful relationships. I mean, Bigler's relationship with his drunk buddy, mm-hmm. Parnell, is so great. And then, you know, Maida, the secretary,
yeah,
was awesome. I mean, it's so wonderful that they had Eve Arden playing that role, and she just gives that so much more personality and three-dimensionality than, you know, most films would have even allowed for, instead of just being, you know, some secretary who establishes the beginning of a phone call. She's kind of, you know, Paul Bigler's mother and boss in some ways, even though he doesn't even have the money to pay her, you know.
Yeah.
It's great. Like, there's so many really beautiful moments in this film.
And the funniest thing about how kind of complex and moving and deliberate this film is the fact that for a generation of people around our age, probably the most recognizable touchstone of this movie is the hyper chicken on Futurama, who every single case introduces himself as just a simple country lawyer. To me, it's just one of those bizarre things where there's absolutely nothing wrong. Like, they didn't overdo that. They didn't overplay that. There's nothing wrong with it in the world of the film. But because of the fact that it's been picked out and singled out as like a cultural meme years after the movie, every time something was said about how he's a simple and modest, and it's like, yeah, this is basically like, I keep flashing to the chicken. And so
Yeah, there's a couple things like that that, you know, you look at what enters the cultural currency, and it's funny because that's probably, if you had asked anybody working on this film, what do you think will be the lasting takeaway culturally, that would not make their list.
No, not at all. And I'm always, it's funny because the fact that that became like a cultural meme, it's almost the reverse of Scream. Scream is a movie that is kind of Frankenstein together from the like kind of cultural memes of other films and other stories. And it's very intentional and it's very deliberate, and that's how they built the film. So the idea that this other film was constructed to be a very serious look at some very serious issues, and that periodically throughout it, all I could think was of the Hyper Chicken. It's this kind of weird inversion.
I mean, I think that definitely there's other things that should be taken away from this, and watching it and seeing how well researched the law was, and how, you know, this is a weird thing, and I'll try to steer this little tangent. It's not too long, but I remember before I went to law school, I watched a ton of Law and Order, and I just found it entertaining, and I would put it on in the background. Mm-hmm. And then after I had gone to law school and taken the bar, I cannot watch it anymore, because just their sustains and overrules are 75% incorrect.
Yeah.
And I think that they paid such close attention to actually making sure that those are still narratively interesting and not dry and boring, and they don't lose you, but they're always done the way that they would actually play out in court. Mm-hmm. And just getting in the rape is something where, if this movie had been done by a lesser writer and a lesser director now, it would just be in. It would just be in. You know, they would just start talking about it. And there would never be that nuanced explanation that this isn't admissible until a door gets opened. And we have to nudge that door open. And we have to do it in the most professional and correct way. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's that silly scene of when they have the sidebar at the, you know, with the judge about the word panties.
Yeah.
And it, for me, you know, that was the only moment where I'm like, oh my God, just call it underwear. You know? But I don't know. I don't know, in the 50s, maybe that wasn't a word that was used for undergarments, that, you know, she obviously there were references to whether or not she wore a girdle and this whole thing. So there's a lot of stuff that's like, okay, I get it. This is just a period film, and I'm not living in that time anymore. So,
yeah,
you know, that gets lost in translation, but it's so accurate otherwise.
Yeah, and it's one of those oddball things. I think that in order to know definitively whether that scene has, like, credibility, like, you'd have to go into, like, some semiotic argument of 70 years ago, and it's kind of like, okay, probably not worth the amount of research that it would take to try to uncover that now.
It definitely felt very modern and fresh, because I think it was so bold for that time.
Yeah.
So you look at stuff like Matlock, or, you know, other courtroom dramas that were fictional in film or on television, And it was very watered down because of censorship and because of, you know, sponsors and producers going, I don't know, we're probably not going to let that in because it's too dicey. So I think they took a lot of risk, but because of that, they made a timeless film, which is awesome.
Yeah, I think that what's really interesting to me is I recently did like a list because we hadn't created anything in a while, and I did a rundown of like my personal favorite comic book movies, which is not to say the best comic book movies, but the ones that I think are my favorites. And like the things near the top of that list are always the things that were created with a real sense of passion. And it's like, this doesn't exist because a marketing algorithm says so. This exists because somebody really, really wanted to get this thing made in the way that it got made. And that's,
yeah, and I think we talked about that a little bit on the last podcast we did, how, you know, one of my favorites is Mystery Men, which is such a bizarre, weird movie that a lot of big comic book people don't even know exists, because why would they? Because it's like a side character's side movie.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, and I actually, when we have like a couple of really, really regular listeners who interact with me regularly, and one of them listened to the podcast and said to me, like, oh, I was really surprised by some of your choices. I didn't know that Ghost World was a thing that existed.
Oh, my.
And it's just kind of like, yeah, that's like, when we were working at the video store, Ghost World was one of those movies that I was constantly hand-selling to people, because that was, like, Emerald City is the kind of place where you learn about a movie like that.
Yeah, I loved that. I loved having that really broad access, and also just the different people who helped curate, you know, not like knowing that you had limited amount of time and unlimited amount of films, and then just being like, all right, well, what do I take home tonight?
Yeah.
I feel like we were extremely, extremely lucky, because it was pre-internet. I mean, now I guess you could just look at a podcast or a blog or, you know, someone who has similar tastes to you, or look at Tumblr and go down a wormhole. But at that time, if your friends weren't suggesting it, like, okay, we're going to see this movie, you know, if you didn't work at a video store or a comic book store, I guess, if that was like your other in, then how would you have found out about all these movies?
And I think that's still probably like that. That's part of like the value of doing something like this, other than just the fact that it's fun to actually have a chance to talk about this stuff again. But like anybody who's listening to this, like there's a half decent chance that even if they've seen Anatomy of a Murder, and even if they've seen Scream, they haven't seen, like, say, The Town That Dreaded Sundown, which is a movie that gets overtly referenced within Scream, and, like, was exactly the kind of movie that used to kill at video stores, but I think has largely been forgotten in the, like, post-home video era.
Well, the other thing, too, and I don't know if you've read the piece, but someone wrote recently, I think it was The Atlantic or something, about how, you know, Netflix not having any movies that, you know, are pre-1980 or even pre-1989 is hurting so many people, because there's a bidding war for it, and you have to pay more to get licensing for a lot of these movies, and you get TMC and Criterion and everything. But a lot of the older movies that maybe aren't Hallmarks slip through the cracks. And I definitely still will pick up random VHS that I find at Goodwill and flip it on eBay, because it's not streaming and it's not on DVD. And they're great, and people are on the lookout for them, and they want to find this title. And unless you're literally scanning your TV listings for like weeks and months in advance, you're going to miss that one time it shows at 3 a.m. on some local station, or you have to have like full and complete satellite dish access to every channel ever to try to score some of these. They're not online. So I really do hope that, that's something that we're going to get more of, is access to older movies.
Yeah. It's really interesting that, like, right now, and people always say that there's more comics and there's more movies and there's more options for entertainment than there ever were. And that's technically true. But in where that kind of gets lost in translation, I think, is that there are still like one or two super mainstream conduits for people to discover stuff. And those things are significantly more limited than the old conduits were. So that, you know, yes, there are more good comic books coming out right now than ever before, but there's no newsstand distribution. And if you aren't a person who goes to a comic book store, you're not going to know that. And similarly [S2] Yeah. [S1] With movies, like, everybody has a Netflix account. Almost nobody has a Filmstruck account. So the fact that Filmstruck has the Criterion Collection doesn't actually make it accessible to very many people.
Yeah, and it's one of those situations where I don't even know if that's going to last. I don't know how long they're going to have it, because, you know, before that it was Hulu.
Yeah.
And then, so it's just like, you have to kind of make your mark and make that foundation like Netflix did.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, hope that the algorithm that predicts what people want. And I don't know, this is definitely kind of going off the beaten path on this podcast a little bit. But if you think about like Lost and how, you know, you probably talk about losting, you know, how mm-hmm. you're watching something and you're losting it because you're trying to do the whole sort of like fanfic, like, here's what I think is going to happen.
Yeah.
And, you know, a lot of people have basically discredited Lost's ending by saying they started reading the comments a little too much and it influenced them. And I think that happens in places like Netflix, and hopefully not Filmstruck, but where they start going, oh, well, our algorithms and our comments show that we could drop, you know, all this stuff because it's not getting watched.
Mm-hmm.
And it kind of forces very quality, wonderful work down to the back burner and then off the grid because, you know, because people don't happen to be watching it right then and there. And then it falls out of favor, you know, and just because something's not popular for a moment in time doesn't mean it's not worth having the same access to it.
Yeah. And it's tough because access right now is transient. Like the thing about back when physical media was king was whether it's a video store or a record store or like whether you had to rent it or buy it, that stuff was still out there. Like, 5-10 years ago, even, if I said, you know, I really want to watch Dogma, which was a movie that was a big financial success and you know, most, you know, it's certified fresh on Rotten Tomatoes and blah, 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 blah. I could pretty much assume that somewhere within 10 miles of my house, I could go and acquire a copy of that disc. Now that's not the case, and also because it had a weird rights situation, you can't stream it anywhere. So that particular film, if you want it, you have to buy the DVD and then wait for it to be delivered. So it's like we have fundamentally changed the way we consume media in the name of convenience, but it's really only convenient as long as what you want is within a fairly narrow kind of construct of what people want enough to be worthwhile to the streamers. I'm not even just picking one movie. I literally the other day went to Soundgarden and I bought two movies, which I could not have found anywhere else in the Syracuse area, and you can't stream. I bought Dogma and Bubba Hotep.
And those are, you know, those are movies that are not only hard to find in Syracuse, but I live in San Francisco, and I'm sure it would take me a good few days to track those down here. You know, there are some good video stores, but there's this kind of like the opposite effect where it's over curated. So you're not going to find a Boba Hotep. You're not going to find Dogma because those aren't, you know, they're not cool and hip enough. They're not like, they don't have that like level of avant-garde and of, you know, tastemaker approval where they're going to be found in a small video store that considers itself, you know, not mainstream.
So right.
You either have the, you know, what was last summer's blockbusters and you're going to get, you know, 25 copies of them, or you're going to get the stuff that's very highbrow or just happens to be in favor at that moment. And it's curated down to whatever people can afford to rent in a big city. Because like, you look at San Francisco, you look at New York City, you don't have the floor space that Emerald City had or Chimney's had or your average Blockbuster had, you know, 20 years ago. You've got a 500 square foot location and it's got to have everything that you're going to be carrying at that moment.
Yeah, and it's interesting when you look at like Vidiot's in LA. They still, I don't think, have opened a new location yet. And that was, as far as I can tell, they closed because they couldn't afford the kind of real estate that you have to have in LA to have the kind of collection they had. And so now they are like a nonprofit organization that does screenings and like, and it's still technically a video store, but A, there's no location right now, so nobody can go and rent. All they're doing is doing screenings to finance their next location. So it's that weird thing of like, even when you get to the point of like, oh yeah, there are still some really great video stores out there, like the best and biggest of them still have trouble functioning in kind of the cultural economy that we've built up for entertainment. It's really disappointing, and I understand it. Like, I'm not looking at anything through rose-colored glasses and going like, I don't understand how it got this way. But I also kind of see it as there was a lot of short-term thinking that brought us here because there were so many people who saw how cool Netflix was, like, you know, when it launched and saw that this is basically...
I think there's another thing that happens with Netflix, and I don't know if you have this phenomenon, but I have a tendency to pick the lowest common denominator of whatever I'm interested in when I am searching Netflix. And I don't know if it's their format or if it's just me, but I will even kind of make a mental note of something that might be a little more risky or a little more edgy or something I don't have as much information about, and kind of go, oh, I'll watch that next time when I'm in the mood for it.
Yeah.
But I'm going to default to watching, you know, Orange is the New Black or Jessica Jones or whatever, because it's easy. It's right there. And 9 times out of 10, it's a Netflix production. So yeah. I think they're kind of doing that on purpose. But at the same time, like, if you have to physically find the thing and that's what you're looking for instead of browsing, then you're gonna get what you had in mind to begin with and not just like default to that next best thing that's just easier.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of weird elements to it too. Like, I rewatch the hell out of stuff. I like my favorite films I'll watch every 6 months. So I think that certainly there's an element of back when physical media was the default, you wouldn't get stuff you've seen already at the video store because you probably own it. Whereas, and so there's like a sense of opportunity cost at the video store. It was like you could get a new movie you knew was going to be sexy and then pick up an older one that might or might not interest you as much because it was free. And now everything's free, and so everything is kind of on an equal footing. And I think you know.
And I remember this, like, this conversation I had with a friend when we went to a record store a few years back, and the idea of how when you had to spend, you know, between $10 and $15 on a record or even a CD, and you went out, you got it, you brought it home, that was in your player for like weeks, and you would just listen it to death because that was the one thing that you got. But now that you can like download 5 or 6 albums, you kind of go, well, I don't have to listen to any of these because I'm not committed. They're just there and I have them now. So you just think of that as like that weird mental ownership thing of like, these are here so I can just watch them whenever. And as opposed to, you know, I guess the translation from record to video rental was you had it for the 3 days you rented it for. You better watch it. There was a deadline on your consumption. And I think that that kind of went away. I mean, you still get the rentals, I guess, on Google Play or whatever that expire, but it's kind of always there in the ether to pick out, or it's not, or the next time you go to find it, it's just no one has it anymore.
Yeah. I actually, it's funny. I used, you know, obviously I worked at video stores for a long time. I used to rent movies all the time. I just don't rent anything anymore. Like if I am interested in a movie, I'll just find the cheapest place that I can purchase it because I don't know. Like there's something about the kind of ethereal quality of, or ephemeral, excuse me, quality of, like cloud-based movies, and that I don't want that deadline. And so when I didn't have Anatomy of a Murder, I just bought it on Vudu because it was $7.99.
Yeah.
And like it just literally doesn't occur to me to rent things anymore because if it's not available on, you know, one of the streaming services that I have a subscription to, then my next instinct is it available on Vudu? Is it available on Amazon? Or do I have to buy the DVD?
I rent for my daughter because I don't need to own Sing.
That's true.
I do not need to own Trolls. These are things that will be watched because they are requested, but I don't want them in my home. I don't want them on my server.
That's fair. See, my son has autism, and so he thrives on routine. So once we've seen something, that'll be in rotation for like a solid 4 months. And so like renting something for him is just a total non-starter. Like I as soon as he wants something more than once, I'm just like, okay, screw it, it's ours now.
Yeah, that makes sense. That makes sense. I always try to just kind of avoid that. I'm a terrible parent because I have not introduced Frozen into our world. I had a really kind of creepy moment where I was at the playground with my daughter, and I have not seen Frozen, but I know snippets of the songs, and I heard her singing a little tiny, imperceptible almost, like, couple word refrain from a song that I know is from Frozen.
Yeah.
And I just kind of looked at her and went, what is that? She goes, I don't know, but I heard Gia singing it. And it's just like, oh, it's a literal virus. It's not just like, this is an actual like infestation of children's brains. So I've been trying to avoid that kind of, she'll go to kindergarten and you know, the floodgates will be open and everything will have to be introduced as she gets the information about it. But at this point, we're still really curating what, because you do that. I mean, even Maya will want to watch a movie 7 or 8 times, and I get it because then you know it, and then it's a comfortable thing, and then it's predictability, and and you feel empowered because you know it now.
Yeah.
So I totally get that. I can do it with certain movies and not others. We should do an episode where we talk about like what films we can do.
Oh yeah.
1,000 times in a row and
yeah.
And why?
One of the like special episodes I want to do that is not about two specific movies, but just a general thing is I want to talk, it's like the opposite of that, which is I want to talk about the movies that have been totally ruined for us by the video store.
Oh God. Like, or like the generational divide of what year were you born where you were born knowing that Darth Vader was Luke's father.
Yeah.
Like, I just knew that. That I think at 6 months old, I think I got that in utero or something. There, it was never a surprise.
You yeah, no, same here.
Within the public consciousness. Like, of course he is. And some people got that as a shock. Like, that's crazy to me. That was like a big reveal and where people's minds were blown. Because how could your mind be blown? Of course he is.
Well, and that's going back to Scream. That's one of the things that really, like, they were really pretty heavy-handed with making it obvious that the boyfriend, that Billy was the killer. And
oh yeah,
I get that part of that is because they were going to do the bait and switch of him ostensibly dying. But the whole time I was thinking, okay, if I hadn't been watching Riverdale last season and I hadn't kind of remembered, oh yeah, Skeet Ulrich was the killer in Scream, because obviously when he was a suspect in Riverdale, it became the, like, wouldn't it be kind of funny if the killer from Scream was also the killer on Riverdale? But I kept questioning myself, like, would I have remembered? Like, would it have been a surprise? Would I have not seen every single thing of, like, him trying to seduce her and then knowing in the back of my head that, like, one of the quote-unquote rules is that she can't have sex. And so when he first shows up and the very first thing he does is try to seduce her, would it have been so sketchy if, you know, and so to me, it's like, it's almost that same kind of thing of, like, because it's just out there in the cultural zeitgeist and, you know, Skeet Ulrich's most famous role is that he's the killer from Scream. Like, if you didn't know that, would it really be that obvious? I think it would, but it's hard to know.
Yeah, I love that the central role of the guys in Scream is that they're cinema buffs. Because, mm-hmm. you know, that's always fun for me and probably yeah. for you too. Because having this vast knowledge of movies and having that running commentary, it's like you're in on the joke. And then there's people who probably get it mm-hmm. and they see those people as a stereotype, but they're not as in on the joke.
Right.
You know, maybe they didn't spend their entire teen existence talking about movies like 6 hours a day. So I always wonder in that, specifically in this movie, how much do I identify with that just because of my circumstances?
Yeah, yeah.
You know?
Yeah, and it's such an interesting, like, and again, I kind of feel like I was 16 when this movie came out, and it felt very, very different than things that had come before it. And in my head, I can't think of anything pre the mid-90s that acted the way this movie acts, but, like, to me, it felt like such a weird shift of being so incredibly self-aware in a way that, like, I know really cheap, really schlocky movies had been this kind of self-aware in the past, but I feel like a mainstream major motion picture that they spent a decent amount of money to make, like, you didn't get movies like this back then. Like, you didn't get...
And I think that this movie was also, it was hyper-polished.
Mm-hmm.
It looked so good. It looked so, like, MTV... video, everyone's hair,
yeah.
their outfits, which are crazy dated now.
Oh yeah.
You look at movies like Jawbreaker and Josie and the Pussycats and this whole era of movies and that, like, Technicolor, it's almost like the musicals of the 50s. Like, now everything's kind of got that, like, if it's a slasher or noir genre mm-hmm. thing. It's got, like, you look at Riverdale and it's kind of sitting on the fence between yeah. this, between Scream and like Twin Peaks, because everything is like that Twin Peaks, like the yeah. color palette and the way that everything's weird and like cinematic and more auteur.
Yeah.
Whereas this is straightforward comic book land, and obviously Riverdale is yeah. literally comic book land, but it has that like noir mashup to it.
I think that what's really interesting about that idea is what you're looking at right now, and the media that's being created right now is the first generation of content being created by people our age who grew up with Star Wars. And that one of the big things that's been repeated so often that it's now just taken for granted is that one of the things that makes Star Wars more artistically credible than Star Trek is the idea of this kind of used universe where you walk in and everything feels grimy and everything feels dented and it's not your first day on the Enterprise ever. And so it's interesting because I think that part of the reason everything looks like this right now is because there's a generation of film students who have been told that that's what made this movie great.
And a lot of times it's very disappointing because you'll see stills or trailers or teasers for something and it tricks you because it looks like it's going to be good, but the narrative's not there mm-hmm. and it doesn't hold it up. And I think, you know, you look at Star Wars, for me, looked good because it wasn't CGI. And I will always, if you ever need a foil for anything that you talk about, any comic book movie ever, I will sit there and I will poo-poo every comic book movie for how flat and plastic and garbage it looks because of its abuse of CGI. And I don't know. It's just,
you would probably,
the part of my brain that I need it to, because it's, I like blank out on anything like Lord of the Rings, even. I'm yeah. just like, nah, I don't care.
You would probably really enjoy, occasionally we'll do essentially reaction videos where Zach and I will go to a movie and then like sit in the car and talk about it. And I've been just calling that, instead of trying to make it an episode because it doesn't really fit the format, I've been calling it New Release Wall. And usually we'll just push it out totally unedited within like an hour of when it's finished so that we can get that immediate rush of like, here's what we thought when we left the theater and, you know, an hour ago. You would probably really enjoy the one we did of Spider-Man Homecoming because it's like an hour and a half of us being like, you know, this is a pretty good movie, but let's dissect the crap out of everything and especially the fact that nothing in this movie looks like it was there.
Yeah, and I feel this way about animation too. And in San Francisco, we've got the Walt Disney Museum and you can go and you can look at the stills and the actual layers, like the 10 different celluloid layers mm-hmm. of cells that were hand painted for each frame of like Snow White or Sleeping Beauty.
Yeah.
And then you get like, you know, Trolls.
Yeah.
Or any of the it's so flat and there's just so little life to it. It looks just so, I don't know, unappealing to me.
I mean, even
I prefer something schlocky like the old War of the Worlds where it's literally a hand puppet.
Yeah.
You know, like that's fine. Or Clash of the Titans looks like garbage, but it's someone's craft looks fun to me.
Yeah.
And I know that CGI is someone's craft. I'm not knocking them. It's hard work. And for what they do it well. It's just not for me.
Yeah, I'm somewhere in the middle because obviously, like, with what I do for a living, if I was, like, passionately anti all that stuff, I just wouldn't be able to function.
You would be like Waldorf and what's his face.
Yeah, exactly. Chandler and Waldorf. Just, which I feel like sometimes because I have this weird thing where I actually like the DC movies that everybody hates more than the Marvel movies, because the DC movies feel like they're trying and failing to do something really cool, whereas the Marvels feel like they're playing it incredibly safe.
Oh, yeah, it's like Mad Libs. Like, okay, so here's the one that worked before. Let's fill in the blanks and do it again.
And it's particularly telling when, like, the way you're describing the Mad Libs thing is particularly interesting, because the Marvel movies that I really liked was Captain America, the first one that was set in World War II, and then the Guardians of the Galaxy movies, because they felt so different. They felt very much like a trauma movie made for $200 million. And the fact that now Marvel's putting out a Thor movie that is just copy, paste, repeat of Guardians of the Galaxy, like the color palette and the music and the everything, it's like literally just, hey, Guardians worked. And I'm sure that movie will be tons of fun. It looks like it's going to be fun, but like my brain is probably going to reject it, because it's going to be like, for me, Guardians 2, which was super, super like redundant to the first one, that's fine, because I know that it's coming from a place of passion and from a place where this director has something he wants to do and something he wants to say over the course of three movies. But as soon as you bring in another franchise and just kind of ape the look and the feel and the everything, my brain's going to go, yeah, Guardians was fine, this is not. Like, so it's interesting to me. Like, the Mad Libs is a really good descriptor of it, and it's funny because they clearly are aware of that to some extent, because as soon as the old formula started to feel stale and a new one came up and surprised everybody by making a ton of money, it was like, oh, well, let's just copy that one instead.
Yeah. And I get it. I mean, it's like, there's so much cost and possibility for failure,
mm-hmm.
that if you can get one thing that's like, okay, we did this, so we're just going to template this and not mess with it, because it's one less thing to go wrong. So I get it, but it's not fun for the audience. I mean, it maybe it's fun if you're like 14 to 20 or whatever, and you know, you don't know any different. You haven't gone back and watched the
canon. Yeah. When you're,
I don't think a lot of these kids have.
No, I can't imagine. And I think it's also, it's one of those weird things where when you're gambling with other people's money, it's really, it's difficult to take chances, because what'll happen is when you make a Batman v Superman, immediately the criticism that comes out when the movie doesn't work is, how can you possibly fuck this up? There's like 20 Marvel movies showing you exactly how to do it.
Exactly.
And so even, I mean, double that down for Marvel, because at least Warner has kind of an excuse not to ape the Marvel model, because they want to establish a brand. Like, if you make a Marvel movie that's just terrible, like, immediately everybody from your boss to the critics to whoever is going to be like, how did you even do that? Like, when you look at Inhumans, which has a 4% on Rotten Tomatoes right now, people are kind of like, how did you even, you made an Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. spinoff set in the Marvel Universe, and you managed to make it 50 points less on Rotten Tomatoes than the first season of Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. or any Marvel movie. How's that even possible?
I think it's just like, a lot of times it's like having that Sunday that has too many toppings.
Yeah.
And they're all good. They're all delicious. But just because you had this one thing and this other thing and this other thing, and they were all great standalone or whatever, you start layering it up too much, and it's just sugar overload.
Yeah.
And there's no flavor left. That's how I feel about a lot of these movies. There's no flavor left. It's,
yeah,
you know what you're walking into, and you're not going to get any kind of surprises. Nothing's going to come out of left field.
Mm-hmm. And I will say that to take that all the way back around to the movies we're talking about, that's probably like one of the big carryovers between Anatomy of a Murder and Scream, is that in both cases, they take a pretty safe formula in terms of like, the first film is about a lawyer who is representing somebody who isn't guilty, or who gets found not guilty, excuse me. And the second one is a teen slasher movie. And in a lot of ways, these could be very paint by numbers. And even if you look at the plot, they're fairly paint by numbers plot. But it's the dimensions in between, and it's kind of the small details that make it something that's worth watching again, like 20 or 50 years later. Because I think that while I could tell you at the beginning of these movies, like, oh, here's the event that will probably take place in the third act, you couldn't safely say that either of these movies feels like you knew what was going to happen.
Yeah, they took risks. They definitely took risks, and it paid off. And I think that is a message to you, Hollywood. You got to start taking risks again, because you're going to find that audience. And, like, you know, Scream did amazingly well in the box office. It got brought back to theaters because so many people lamented not seeing it or wanting to see it in the theaters again.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's this thing you hear over and over again, like, the reason that we do these things so big is because it's the way to get people to actually go and see things in the theater instead of streaming them. I don't necessarily think that that's true, because I think, you know, you've got that captive audience. You're not looking at your phone while you're watching something when you're in the theater. You're not distracted by your laptop or your kids or whatever. You're just watching the film. And a movie like Anatomy of a Murder would do that, you know, in a heartbeat today, because it gets you, and you want to see where it's taking you. And Scream did the same thing. I think that's definitely a common thread through the two of them.
All right. Any final thoughts before we sign off? Just because it seems like we're kind of naturally coming to a wrap point.
No, it was a pleasure doing this again. Thanks for having me. Really enjoyed rewatching both of these, and can't wait to do it again.
Yeah, my final thought, just because I think it's a funny kind of last point to make, is there's something to be said about the idea that Scream was considered this big gamble at the time because it was a genre that wasn't working. And in the first movie, there's a running gag about the fact that Sydney's life is a movie. And there's a line in there where somebody asks her, who's going to play you in the movie? And in Scream 3, they actually make a movie based on the events of Scream. And there's something to be said for the fact that this movie that was considered a gamble got to get to the point where it had enough sequels that they actually played out the throwaway gag that they mentioned in the first film. Like, there's something bizarrely satisfying about that to me.
Yeah, and I mean, if you're going to take that back to the Marvel movies like we were just talking about, do something like that. You know, take it out of the Mad Lib and say, this is a cool thing we could explore.
Mm-hmm.
Let's set the bait here in the first one. And if we get that third movie, this is what we do. It would be a much more interesting way of unfolding something like that.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Ava. I will let you go, and we can both tend to our respective children and jobs. But really appreciate your taking time, and I will make sure that you see this as soon as it's out there in the universe.
Awesome. Thanks again, and I'll talk to you soon, Russ.
Thanks. And for anybody who's listening, we'll be back next week because Zach and I are going to New York Comic Con. So there's going to be plenty of stuff there. I've got some people who I'm talking to that I won't say on the air because, unfortunately, if it doesn't work out, then I've said something that doesn't exist and I look stupid. But keep watching the feed, because sometime in the next 7 days, there'll be at least one more episode. So thanks for listening.
All right. Thanks. Bye. All right.